This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalbathanchel. It's been 50 years since the U.S. Supreme Court handed down its landmark decision in the case of Miranda versus Arizona. In their decision, the justices established that all criminal suspects must be advised of their right to remain silent before being interrogated by police. It's a right provided by the Fifth Amendment. Today, Where We Live, we find out more about the story behind our right to remain silent. Tejas Bhatt joins me in studio. He's an assistant public defender from Hartford. Tejas, welcome to Where We Live.
Thanks, Lucy. It's a pleasure to be back.
So in our opening for the show, we played a cut from the film adaptation of 21 Jump Street. And just to kind of show that often we hear about Miranda rights from the shows we watched growing up, the movies we saw. And you had an interesting anecdote when we met a few weeks ago about growing up in India and how you learned about Miranda rights.
Right. So I grew up in India and I moved here 16 years ago. So growing up, I didn't have an exposure to Miranda rights. My exposure to interactions between the police and suspects, and they were almost always guilty and the police were the good guys, was the third degree interrogations where the cops would beat the suspects. They would take their belt off and hang them from the ceiling and beat confessions out of them. And then I moved to the U.S. for law school. And even then, in law school, my first exposure to Miranda rights was popular culture. I'm sure most of your listeners and everybody in the United States is well aware of Law and Order, mm-hmm. and it's four different iterations. And that's what everybody knows. You know, the cop arresting the suspect, putting him in the back of the car, and then they start saying, you have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you. And that's sort of where I learned that there was this thing called Miranda rights before I even knew what they were. And I suspect a lot of people who don't go to law school, that's where they get their information about Miranda rights from, is TV shows, movies like 21 Jump Street, any cop procedural. Mm-hmm. And it's how it's become part of our collective consciousness.
Let's find out more about the man behind Miranda versus Arizona. Can you briefly tell us about Ernesto Miranda?
So from what I've learned, Ernesto was a Mexican who lived in Arizona. He didn't do much of note until he was arrested for kidnapping and raping a woman. And the story goes that he was then interrogated for a number of hours. He was forced to sign a confession. And the Supreme Court of the United States took his case up with three others where there were similar arguments that they were sort of forced to give these confessions without knowing what they were doing. The anecdote of him after the fact is that the Supreme Court obviously reversed his conviction. They instituted the Miranda rights. And so he gets a new trial. He gets reconvicted. He serves his time and he gets out. And by that point, he's become a bit of a celebrity because every police officer has their Miranda rights card. And so he goes around making a small living, autographing them. One day he gets into a fight and he gets stabbed himself and he gets killed. And the individual who's the suspect gets arrested by police, but by now they have the Miranda rights. So the suspect gets read his Miranda rights, and he invokes his right to remain silent and does not give a confession. They don't have enough against him, and they have to let him go.
Wow. Talk about full circle.
Absolutely. The irony of that is quite amusing. The guy who was instrumental in getting these rights instituted for all of us himself ended up without justice because the person who killed him had to be let go free.
When we look at the 1966 Supreme Court decision, talk about why the justices ruled the way they did, obviously based on the Fifth Amendment. Is that right?
That's right. It is the Fifth Amendment. And in the Fifth Amendment, there is the clause that we shall have the privilege to be free from self-incrimination, which means we can't be forced to give testimony against ourselves. And the 66 decision, Miranda versus Arizona, and the three others that came with it were sort of the culmination of a long history of these decisions that the Supreme Court had been issuing. Part of it was the idea that you can't force people to give confessions, and that undermines sort of the sanctity of the system. They were concerned about beating confessions out of people. There were a number of decisions that came before it and I think the notable one is Brown versus Mississippi. I think it was in 1939. And that's a pretty horrible story. And that, and then there were, I think there was six or seven others before 1966, which all involved African-American suspects in the South. And they were all suspected of killing white people. And so the guy in Brown versus Mississippi, if I can just tell the story of that, is a guy named Ellington, I think. And the sheriff in the South suspected that he had been involved in killing a white person. So the sheriff and people from the victim's family went to this guy's house. They just went to his door. And they said, you know, you have to confess to this crime. And he said, well, I didn't do it. So they dragged him to one of the victim's houses. They beat him. And he didn't confess. And then they tied him up. And he didn't confess. And then they took him out into a yard and they hung him from a tree and they beat him again. And they said, well, you have to confess. And he says, I didn't do it. So they let him down. They give him another chance to confess and he doesn't. And so this repeats until they keep beating him and he refuses to confess. Finally, they let him go home. 2 days later, the deputy goes back under the guise of arresting him. On the way to the courthouse, the station house, which is in Mississippi, they go through Alabama. And then he's in another state, takes him out of the car, and relentlessly beats him again and says, I'm not going to let you go until you confess. And so finally, Ellington confesses. He gets arrested. He's actually tried and convicted by a jury in a matter of 2 days after his arrest. That, and then there were seven other cases between 39 and 66 where there were African-American defendants who were forced to confess by beating or other coercion or torture by white deputies in the South. And the Supreme Court reversed all of those until finally in 1966, they issued this Miranda decision saying not only do you have to give a confession voluntarily, but before police can start asking you questions, they have to tell you what your rights are. And so that's the backdrop to which Miranda came about.
So Miranda rights changed police procedure in the U.S. I was reading that obviously civil libertarians viewed this as a victory for individual rights, but you had the critics on the other side saying this undermines the efforts of law enforcement officials.
Yeah, there's always that side to it because what people tend to think and critics tend to think in a sense are that it hinders the ability of police to catch the guilty. If you are guilty and the police tell you that anything you say can be used against you and you don't have to speak, then most people will not. I will say as a public defender, reality is quite different. I have seen a vast number of cases that I've represented where the only thing that people have – the prosecution has evidence of guilt is my client's confession. And that is despite being Mirandized and given their warnings. But I think the idea we have to keep in mind is that these rights apply to all of us. Mm-hmm. And they apply to all of us regardless of whether we're innocent or whether we're guilty. We can't start deciding that the constitutional rights don't apply to some people just because we have determined in advance that they have committed a crime. My advice to everybody is that if the police want to question you about something, don't answer the questions. Get a lawyer. Because even though you think that you have done nothing wrong, you don't know what laws there are out there. You don't know what you might end up getting arrested for. And that's why I think the safeguards exist, not to protect the guilty, but to protect the innocent. And I think it's important for all of us to remember that, you know, take a look at all our landmark decisions. They don't come about in the cases of innocent people. You know, Miranda, as I just said, was a rapist and a kidnapper. Gideon versus Wainwright, which established a right to counsel or right to an attorney for all poor people. He was a robber and a pool shark. These are not upstanding citizens. But if we start saying that these rights don't apply to them, then they would never apply to us.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. In studio with me is Tejas Bhatt, assistant public defender from Hartford. We're looking back at 50 years since the Miranda versus Arizona decision by the U.S. Supreme Court, which gave us Miranda rights. I had just a question for you procedurally. So if someone is arrested and they're not Mirandized, what happens to their case?
Right. So that's a great question because that comes up all the time. And I hear this from clients. You know, I got arrested, but they didn't Mirandize me, so they didn't read me my rights. So they got to throw the case out. That's not true. So the only time the police have to actually read you these rights is if they're going to question you about the crime, if they're going to interrogate you. They don't have to do it if they're just going to ask you routine booking questions. And that's what you see a lot of, frankly, is, you know, they arrest somebody, they take them to the police station, they're fingerprinting them or getting their information, and the guy just blurts out and says, well, I did, you know, I didn't do it, or I did it, but I was desperate or something. And then they say, well, I was being interviewed and they didn't read me my rights. Well, no, they weren't questioning you. So if the police aren't questioning you, they don't have to read you your rights. If they are questioning you and they don't read you the rights, then the any confession has to be suppressed. And so that's sort of the quirk of this, which a lot of people aren't really aware of. But I get that a lot.
So you're an assistant public defender. You represent dozens, if not hundreds of people a year. Talk about a little bit more about, I know you have attorney-client privilege, but in terms of just background, do people understand the Miranda rights and why they're there?
That's I think some do. I think a lot of people don't. And I think that's why it's the question of whether a confession can be used against someone is not limited to just whether the Miranda rights have been given. Because I see a lot of people who have read their rights. And now with the advent of all interrogations being videotaped, it's a great boon because you can watch this happen in sort of real time, as it were. You sit there and you watch them and they read these rights. And you know that it takes longer to read than they're taking on the video. But a lot of people will skim them. A lot of people feel the pressure of being in a interrogation room in a police station. And they know that they're going to be pressured into talking. And so they go through the motions. I think a lot of them know what the rights are but are afraid to exercise them. I think that's the greater concern. You know, unless you're completely illiterate, I think people will read them and they'll sort of have this awareness, as we all do, of what the rights are. But I think there's a gap between understanding and having the knowledge and wherewithal to exercise those rights. Because that, in that environment, it's a very difficult thing to do.
You're talking about that environment. So we hear about the stories of people that have, you know, gone to jail for years because of false confessions. You know, talk about what that interaction is between someone who may be intimidated and, you know, the police are an authority figure and, you know, because of the circumstance, they admit to something they didn't do. I mean, can you talk about how that interchange happens?
Right. And so there's a very famous method of interrogations that the police use. It's called the Reed method. It's like a 9-step process. And it's basically psychological torture in a sense. What they do is they don't threaten people anymore. They don't harm them. They do is they pressure them, and they use this method. So you go, essentially, how it usually happens is when someone is brought in for questioning, the police bring them there, which means that they have no direct means of leaving. They're reliant on the police to leave, or they have to call somebody to come in and get them. Which means, in essence, they're sort of captive. Now, they're told you're free to leave at any time you want. But if you've just taken me to the police station that's 8-10 miles from my home without my car, how am I going anywhere? They're usually windowless, small rooms with a small table, two police officers, and the suspect sitting up against the wall. Some questionings will go on for hours, 2 hours, 3 hours, four. There's some cases where they've gone on for 9 or 12 hours of questioning. You know, you offer, I'm your friend, let me get you some water, I'll get you some food. They use tactics which include outright lies. And that's another thing. Police are allowed to lie to you when they question you. So they will say, we've got DNA. We know it's you. We've got 4 eyewitnesses who put you at the scene. We just want to hear your side of the story. And when you're faced with 12 hours of questioning, you're away from, let's say, your children. You don't know where they are, your family. They don't know where you are. The police keep telling you, you've done it, you've done it. We can help you if you just confess. A lot of people will break down. A lot of people will say, okay, this is my way out. Mm-hmm. My way out of this predicament is to tell them what they want to hear. And if I do it, they'll help me and I'll get to go home again. And the other important thing to remember is that a vast majority or a large percentage of people who end up in our criminal justice system have substance abuse or mental health issues. Mm-hmm. And they are easier to, and I use the word prey, but not in a nefarious way, but they're easier to manipulate. They're easier to mold and pressure into giving false confessions. And police are aware of that. And the bad ones take advantage of that. The good ones don't, but the bad ones do. And that's how you end up with people who falsely confess. And you're absolutely right. If you look at the Innocence Project and their website, they have statistics, and a large percentage of false convictions involve false confessions.
We just have a couple more minutes, Tejas. But, you know, looking back at the 50 years and obviously your role as an assistant public defender, I mean, where do you see that reform and change needs to happen so that the innocent aren't thrown in jail?
Wow.
Big question.
It is a big question, and I think it's a broad question. But in terms of Miranda, I think the problems with it are that our courts are sort of restricting its application. They're carving out exceptions. And even beyond Miranda, the question is, how do we stop people who are vulnerable from giving false confessions? Miranda is a great step. You must be clear to everybody what their rights are. I think what you see a lot of are interrogators not really honoring that request. You know, if they have people ask vague questions, can I get a lawyer? Should I have my lawyer here? I think the right thing to do is to interpret that as a right, as an invocation, not say, well, you can have a lawyer, but then it won't help you, and sort of deflect the question. I think we got to remember that a lot of people who get caught up are vulnerable and that our rights should be absolute when it comes to that. I think we're going to have to look at how juveniles are treated. I know you've done some work into that, into looking at juveniles in our system. And juveniles are especially vulnerable. And we have statutes in our books that are sort of very counterintuitive when it comes to confessions of juveniles. If you're a juvenile and you're interrogated by police, but you're not advised of your certain rights, that statement is not allowed to be used against you in juvenile court. But if you are then transferred to adult court, that statement is now suddenly admissible. And it's backwards. It doesn't make any sense. You know, our courts and our legislators need to look at that a little closer and say, how are we protecting the 15-year-olds and 16-year-olds from succumbing to the pressures of police interrogations? And I mean, can't imagine anyone more vulnerable, 15, 16-year-olds sitting in a police station with a guardian sitting there saying, you better tell them the truth, or, you know, you, if you don't cooperate with them, you're going to go away for a long time. And that's really not helpful to our youth. So,
yeah. I'm speaking with Connecticut public defender Tejas Bhatt about the 50th anniversary of Miranda versus Arizona. The landmark Supreme Court case guaranteed the right of an individual to remain silent if arrested. You can read Tejas's blog at criminalopinions.wordpress.com, and also some other interesting reading about the history behind Miranda versus Arizona. We'll tweet that link out on our Twitter at Where We Live. Tejas, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Lucy.
Coming up, we look at food insecurity in Connecticut and across the country. New data's out. It may surprise you. This is Where We Live.
Stand up for your right. Get up.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We tend to think about the people in our communities who don't have enough to eat around the holidays, but it's a problem that exists year-round. New national data finds that 85% of food-insecure households with children are headed by adults who work, and one-third of food-insecure households have annual incomes of at least two times the federal poverty level. We'll hear more about the national data later in the hour. We wanted to check in with the Connecticut Food Bank to find out about food insecurity in our state. The food bank provides food to those in need through a network of community-based programs like soup kitchens, food pantries, and shelters. I want to welcome Bernie Beaudreau, CEO of the Connecticut Food Bank, to Where We Live.
Thank you. Nice being here.
I understand that you're fairly new in the Connecticut job, right?
I am new. I just completed my fourth week on the job and really enjoying it very much. Connecticut is a beautiful state. I'm getting to know a lot of the people. It's a great place to be.
Great. Well, I wanted to ask you, because of your experience helping those in need, Explain the term food insecure, food insecurity. What does it mean to be food insecure?
Well, in simple terms, it means not really knowing where your next meal is going to come from and being in that condition from time to time. It is actually a measure that's been developed over the last 25 years. The U.S. Census Bureau does a survey of 65,000 households every year, randomly selected, and basically asks a battery of 13 questions that gets at the problem of really unable to really plan their week-long meals and actually experiencing missing meals. So sometimes it members of the family that miss meals. That's a smaller percentage, but in Connecticut, 13% of the population is actually food insecure. And, you know, this meaning, it really means that people worry about, you know, being able to feed their families and children, worry about whether they're going to get food for supper. And sadly, a lot of people, a lot of families are missing meals.
You mentioned 13% of Connecticut residents at some point have been food insecure, so that's about 473,000 people, according to your website.
That's a lot of people.
That's a lot.
Almost
of people.
A half a million people.
How has that percentage changed over the years? A lot of attention, of course, was on the recession. What's happened in the years since?
Well, the recession that hit the country propels people who are marginal and lose jobs into food insecure situations. So there is an uptick in food insecurity when the recession happens and when there's high unemployment. But it's pretty much constant with the level of poverty we have in our country. Food insecurity is related to income, low incomes, and poverty. And, you know, what we have seen in the last 3 years, from 2012 to 2014, an actual reduction in about 25,000 people in Connecticut. There are fewer. They went from, 498 to 472. Mm-hmm. So that's good, but it's only a 5% reduction. And my assumption is that many more people were employed in that period of time than 25,000. Mm-hmm. It's sort of bouncing back from the recession. So you have a situation where the recession is not lifting all boats. I mean, the rising tide is not lifting all boats. There are people that are stuck in a situation of poverty.
I wanted to ask you quickly how the Connecticut Food Bank works with its member organizations. How many are there around the state? How do you get the food to the people who need it?
Yes, I mean, Connecticut Food Bank is part of Feeding America. Feeding America is organized out of Chicago. Yeah, there are almost 300 food banks in the country. Major food banks in Connecticut are FoodShare, based in Hartford and Tallinn County, and Connecticut Food Bank, the remaining six counties. So together, we get food from various sources and distribute that food through hundreds of outlets, from very tiny food pantries and food closets to well-organized nonprofit organizations that combine food distribution with the kind of other services that people need to kind of get back on their feet, counseling and job training and job placement. So it's a wide range. We also distribute food directly from a fresh produce distribution program, the mobile food pantry. And we go to a number of places in urban areas in particular and distribute food directly to people in need.
We wanted to get some personal stories from people who've, you know, actually experienced food insecurity. One of them is Renee Cody. I understand that she is getting help from a member program of the Connecticut Food Bank called Master's Manna. Renee, welcome to Where We Live.
Hi, how are you? Good morning.
Thank you so much for calling in. And I wanted to go back to something that Bernie was saying in terms of the recession. And how we've seen the number in Connecticut, you know, while there's been a little bit of an improvement, there are still people that are in need of help. And I think you're one of those people who lost their job in the recession. And what's happened since?
Yes. I was actually, I can tell you, the last day I worked was February 19th, 2008. I was pregnant and one of the only sole providers in my household, with my husband being out of work also. It hurt us really bad, you know, having the fear of not knowing where your next meal is, and having a newborn and not knowing where to go and where to turn, And I mean, I was quite stubborn. And I walked through the doors of Masters Man, and Masters Man is a lifeline that, unfortunately, it's not getting any better, like you said. Since then, my husband, thankfully, has found employment where he makes a decent living wage. I still can't find employment anywhere because it's just being out of work for so long and trying, and then having also a child, trying to find something that fits. It's really tough.
Can I ask how you found Masters Manna? This is a human service program in Meriden.
Well, we're based out of Wallingford. We serve Meriden and surrounding towns too. So, my son was about 3 weeks old. We're not where we were now at 46 North Plains in Wallingford. Had a small little storefront, and I finally summed up the courage and said, you know what, I need help. As little as it may sound, diapers for my son. And I walked in, and just to see in that small little, I want to say 400 square storefront, the line that was out the door and down the street and around the corner. And when I saw in, Cheryl Straczynski saw me, and she just came in with my head down. I wanted diapers, and that was it. And she pulled me aside, and she said, "We're here for you. What do you need?" And of course, then I just fell to the ground, sobbing and crying, saying, "I need food for me and my husband. I need diapers and whatever you can give me for my son." So.
And Renee, part of why we wanted to speak with you is, you know, so often there's a perception out there, well, that's not going to happen to me. I mean, I'm secure, and, you know, I don't have a, problem feeding my children, my family. But we never know when the other shoe's going to drop, when we may lose a job, when someone gets a long-term illness. You know, do you find that there are other residents that you've met since 2008 that are in your shoes? You never thought you'd be in this situation, and this is where you need the most help.
Yeah, and this is what I always say to everybody. It's amazing who you see, because it happens to everybody. I was one of that percentage. I came from New Haven, Connecticut, with, you know, a single mother trying to make it, in a time in the late 70s, early 80s. And it's so many people that are there. Believe it or not, it's your son's teacher. It could be your son's soccer coach, your daughter's cheerleading coach, your daughter's dance instructor. It's absolutely everybody. And when I see them, I tell them, I'm in the same boat as you. I just may have a smile on my face, and I have my shoulders back. And it's because of Masters Manna that they gave me the confidence in myself to say, you know what, you need help. Yes, were you one of those that it happened to? But now it's time to give back. And I always say to all the clients there, if I can get out of the fire, you're going to be able to get out of the fire. And you see it. Their shoulders go back. Their heads go up, you know, and they understand that, wow, there's you, of all people, you are in the same boat. And look, it took a while to us to tread. As I say, we're still treading water. But our head, you know, at least our nose is above the water line. Mm-hmm.
In studio with me is CEO of the Connecticut Food Bank, Bernie Beaudreau. So we're hearing Renee's story, Bernie. Can you talk a little bit more about the people in Connecticut that need help like Renee? Again, there's a perception out there, well, there's people that are affected by this. It's not me. It's not my neighbor. It's not somebody at school that my child goes to school with. But who are the people that are struggling?
Renee, thank you so much for sharing your story. I mean, you represent the 60% of the people that are served by this network who have someone in the family who's working. And that's the discouraging part, that when you do find a job, often the job does not pay enough to kind of meet your expenses. So you're still food insecure. In fact, 45% of the people that we serve through our network of food pantries like Masters Manna are not eligible for any other government kind of support. They're not eligible for SNAP or food stamps. They're not eligible for public assistance because their incomes are just above. But, of course, their incomes are not enough to kind of make sure there's enough food on the table. One of the first places I visited was Masters Manna. And, you know, Renee's among a whole group of people who are helped by that place, but she turns and helps the others. And she volunteers there. She's like she said, she brings people along and say, you know, there's no shame in what's going on here. A lot of people are in this boat, and we're here to support you. And I've seen different places do some incredible work just in the 4 weeks I've been here. Treating people with dignity and respect is so important because everybody's got a story, and they're not all the same. Some people are not able to work, but most are looking for a chance to get out of their bind, and food is essential for that process. And increasingly, we're trying to get highly nutritious food, fresh produce, and the food industry has been very generous in that respect. But again, thank you, Renee, for being telling the story that so many people can relate to out there. And if you're hearing this story and you know you're being stubborn and denying yourself the help or your family the help, please don't. There are many helping agencies out there, and they will treat you well and help you get back on your feet.
Bernie, you said something earlier that a lot of people who need help are unable to work. But my understanding is when we talk about SNAP, isn't that a requirement that they have to have a job or trying to find work to get those benefits? Isn't that a problem with the way the program is set up?
Yeah, there's been an increasing trend in state policies around food assistance. I'm not familiar with Connecticut's policy requiring work or public service. But that really that makes it doubly difficult. If you're requiring people to put in public service for getting a benefit, then you're taking them away from their ability to get that job they need or job training to get a job. So it's a kind of a – it doesn't make sense to me. I don't think it's necessary, and I think it's saying you owe society something, you know, to have to do that. And everybody wants to pull their own weight. You know, very few people are taking advantage of a system that's trying to help out. People don't like standing in lines. It's not a pleasant experience. And there are lines that that form in the coldest of days in the winter.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We're talking about food insecurity in Connecticut. Later we're going to find out what's happening nationwide. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call. Have you experienced food insecurity? That means not having trouble finding food to put on your family's table. I want to take a call now from Marshall in Hartford. Marshall, you're on Where We Live.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I just want to briefly share an observation with you and the listeners. When I was out of work for a while, I was going through the food share in the Hartford area, and they would have them in different locations on different days. And what I started noticing was there would be people representing, and I'm not going to say where, but different restaurants in throughout the city. And they would come to the food chairs and then bring the food back to the restaurants, and I guess they would turn around and sell them to the general public. And I was just curious if there was any way of, or if there's any safeguards to make sure that the food really gets to the people that really need it.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Marshall, for your call. A good question. Bernie, can you answer that?
Well, I can't answer, you know, why that happens. I mean, people do take advantage of situations. I know Food Share and Connecticut Food Bank, we have very strict standards in terms of our membership to Feeding America. We have to have monitoring take place. We have staff that go out and account for things. So we're assured that most, in the vast majority of every pound that goes out, our food banks gets to people in need. But there's always the possibility that someone can beat the system. And so we're sorry about that, and we don't want to spend more dollars to try to get to the 1% that may be taking advantage. Mm-hmm. I think we just have to factor that in, that some small percentage is not going to get to where it needs. We're going to focus on moving the food further and faster to those who do need the food.
Renee, I wanted to go back to you. Renee Cody, a client of Masters Mana, a human service program in Meriden. She's been good enough to share her personal story about, reaching a point in her life after losing a job. Her husband also struggling now that he's working. That's a great thing. But, you know, at some point you needed help and you were able to find that through Masters Mana. But food insecurity isn't just about being able to find meals to feed your family. There's other stress that goes along with it that impacts your health. Can you talk about that, Renee?
Yes. While all this was going on, raising my son and also struggling looking for work during the recession and everything else, worrying about house bills and everything that goes along with it, we ended up being evicted twice almost. And because of all the stress at 33, I had a heart attack from the stress of just wondering where am I going to get money for the lights and where am I going to money for the rent and where are we going to live? And just being in that limbo of you qualify for this, but you don't qualify for that because you make maybe $5 too much, and it really, really weighed on me. And then I ended up having a heart attack and being in Hartford Hospital because of just the stress and the load of loan of trying to say, okay, house or food. And you really shouldn't ever have to come to that situation, house or food.
Any reflection on programs? I know we were talking about SNAP, which is the Federal Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, Renee, but any programs in the state that are helping you, or now that we are hearing about budget cuts across the board, programs that are impacted here in Connecticut?
And that was one thing after I had rested from and healed from having my heart attack, I said, you know what, I have to be proactive and I have to go find these programs. There's the energy assistance that was at New Opportunities in Meriden. They will set up, you get money, a certain stipend amount of money towards your back bill. And it keeps the lights on, so we qualified for that. And then it was, there's so many programs out there. And the shame is with these budget cuts, they're drying up and or disappearing. And these are ones that I see on a daily basis with everybody that comes walking in. They're like, well, where can I go? I need oil for hot water, because you still need oil, even though you heat with it, you still need to have hot water. Mm-hmm. And so, I have that information and be able to say, possibly go down to New Opportunities, hand them, the phone number and say, and here's the address and say, and just go down and see what happens, but with the money that's drying up, the award amounts are getting smaller and smaller, which then you're taking from your food budget and you're taking from your rent and all these other things that are necessities for you to live.
Go ahead. Oh, I'm sorry, Renee. We're almost out of time for this segment, but I really appreciate you sharing your story with us here on Where We Live. Again, Renee Cody, a client of Masters Mana, a human service program in Meriden. We're going to talk more about the programs that exist out there, and we're going to take a nationwide look at food insecurity. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. Today, we're talking about food insecurity in Connecticut and nationwide. Comment on our website, WMPR.org, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. So who is food insecure? Often the perception is a person or family that lives below the poverty line. But new data shows that one-third of households that have trouble putting food on the table have annual incomes of at least two times the federal poverty level. Why is this significant? Because these working households can have trouble qualifying for the Federal Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, known as SNAP, and other food support programs like subsidized school meals. In studio with me is CEO of the Connecticut Food Bank, Bernie Beaudreau. Now joining us on the phone is Diane Whitmore-Schanzenbach, director of the Hamilton Project at the Brookings Institution. Diane, welcome to Where We Live.
Thanks for having me.
Can we look at a snapshot of the nation? What are we seeing across the country in relation to food insecurity?
Sure. Well, we've seen that as after the Great Recession, during the Great Recession, there was a spike in food insecurity, and it hasn't really come down. You know, even though the economy has picked up steam, still a lot of lower-income and lower-middle-income families are really struggling to get by. Part of that is because, you know, they're increasing prices of rent, you know, wages have been stagnant, and so on. And, you know, as budgets get tighter and tighter, people have a harder time affording their basic needs like food.
Are there certain regions of the U.S. that are more affected by food insecurity than others?
Food insecurity is well distributed across the United States. There in Connecticut, you've got a rate that's approximately average to the national average. It's a little bit worse in the South, but in particular, I'd be worried about people in the Northeast because that's where we've seen really the largest spikes in housing costs. And so, you know, as housing gobbles up more and more of families' incomes, they have less to spend on other things. And so I'd be particularly worried about the Northeast moving forward.
We were able to hear a personal story from a Connecticut resident about how she lost her job during the recession, has been unable to find work. And so often she says, you know, they kind of cobble things together and find programs in the community that help them. But you mentioned that when resources are getting slimmer and slimmer, I mean, how can this problem be addressed?
I mean, this is a very difficult policy challenge, in part because, as Renee shared in her story, they had too high of an income to qualify for lots of programs that are out there, like SNAP, which serves about one in every eight Americans, and it's, you know, the backbone of our food security, you know, safety net. But a lot of people who are suffering from food insecurity are not qualifying for that. Certainly, you know, local organizations like Master's Manna, like the Connecticut Food Bank, are doing great work in this area. But, you know, money is tight and the need is great. And we really do need to be stepping up with public policies to help these families that are being left out of the safety net today.
And the Hamilton Project, I know you're looking at data, but what are some policy recommendations that your organization has?
Well, so one thing that I think is in dire need of happening is increasing access to food over the summertime for children. So I think now is a perfect time to be talking about food insecurity because during the summer months when children don't have access to school meals, rates of food insecurity spike. And I imagine that they see that at the food banks in Connecticut as well. Something that has been proposed, and I think it's prime time to do this, is to provide extra benefits to families when they lose those school meals during the summertime. So that would be my number one recommendation.
I wanted to turn to Bernie Baudreau, CEO of the Connecticut Food Bank. Did you want to react to what Diane is saying?
No, I think, Diane, you're saying all the, you know, everything that's very true. And I think kind of the rhinoceros in the living room, if you want to call it that, is, you know, low wages and poverty really drives hunger. And, you know, while we can have a robust system of getting donated food and purchase food and take advantage of the government nutrition programs, you know, if work has to pay more, I mean, and that has to be challenged nationally. It's not unique to Connecticut that, you know, the ability for people to kind of work full time and live has gotten more difficult over time. Wages have not inflated. And if we want to seriously drop the hunger percentage and make sure that experiencing hunger or food insecurity is a temporary thing while people can get back on their feet, the getting back on your feet is being able to earn enough income to be able to not be dependent on the system. And I think let's not lose sight of that. It's really an important public policy issue that quite often people don't like to talk about.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We're talking about food insecurity in our country. I wanted to read a tweet that we received from a listener who writes, "Cooking from scratch is a money pit. Boxed foods are cheaper for most people. I'm afraid it's contributing to obesity." Diane, so you know, we do know that there's an obesity epidemic in this country as well. So how do we make sure that people have enough to eat and it's not just the cheap, overprocessed food?
Sure. Just for context, SNAP benefits are about $4.50 per person per day. So if you think about what it would take to make ends meet to feed your family on a budget like that, it's kind of it'll give you pause, right? Nobody can do that very easily. And so just like the tweeter suggested, that means that people rely on low-cost forms of forms of food consumption. One thing that the Hamilton Project just proposed last month was, we think that especially because more people are working and combining work with SNAP receipt, that it's high time to increase the value of SNAP benefits. Our estimates suggest that a 20% increase in SNAP benefits would really make a difference and would improve the quality of what people eat. You know, this basically comes down to economics, that when people have more money to spend, they don't need to rely on those high-density, cheap calories, and that they're more likely to eat fruits and vegetables and the foods that we know that are good for them.
And what you were talking about, Diane, is that what's called modernizing SNAP benefits?
That's exactly right. We had an event last month where we released a policy proposal about ways to improve the SNAP program called Modernizing SNAP Benefits.
I thought I read earlier this year that there are issues with the people that will become eligible for SNAP due to, I think, a three-month limit for people who are unemployed. If they're unable to find work, they can't then get SNAP benefits. Do you know anything about that?
Yes, that's right. So we have strict time limits on adults who don't have any children in the household. So they're working-age adults, they're not disabled. And these are very, very low-income individuals. They don't really have access to other safety net benefits. They're getting, on average, you know, very modest amounts of SNAP benefits. If you were relying only on SNAP benefits, your consumption level would be about 20% of the poverty line. So these are very, very meager benefits. Nonetheless, now that the economy has, the unemployment rate has dropped, they've reinstituted time limits and said to those single adults without children, you know, if you don't find a job within 3 months, even if you're looking for a job, even if there are no jobs to be had, but you're looking for a job, you still are time limited off of SNAP within 3 months. So we think that this is going to cause great hardship to a lot of individuals.
Well, Diane Whitmore Schanzenbach, director of the Hamilton Project at the Brookings Institution. We're almost out of time. I do want to thank you for calling in and giving us your perspective. We're going to have a link to the work that the Hamilton Project does on our website, wmpr.org/where we live. I wanted to turn to Bernie Beaudreau, again, CEO of the Connecticut Food Bank. We just have 2 minutes, Bernie. If people wanted to find out more information about, you know, how they can be helped or how their communities could help people in need, where do they go?
Well, I mean, you can go to our website, the Connecticut Food Bank's website, or go to FoodShare's website. FoodShare serves Tolland County and Hartford County, and Connecticut Food Bank serves the rest of the state. And, you know, we're looking for people to kind of join this fight. If you don't contribute now to these to our organizations, please consider that. And please consider, you know, being an advocate for the kinds of things that Diane was talking about. And, you know, Connecticut as a state could contribute more to the Nutrition Assistance Program. The Connecticut Nutrition Assistance Program is generous, but it could be much more generous. We need the food supply to help people through these tough times. So thanks for the opportunity to be on the program, and we hope everyone will join us.
That's Bernie Beaudreau, again, CEO of the Connecticut Food Bank. We'll continue this conversation on our website, wmpr.org/where we live. Our show is produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives. Our technical producer is Kion Wolf. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Thanks for listening.